Well, good afternoon and welcome to another Anti-Money Laundering Talk Show podcast from KYC 360 with me, Stephen Platt. Today, we're going to be talking about cryptocurrencies and the compliance challenges and opportunities that relate to them with my guest, Edmund McCormack, who is dialing in from the United States. By way of introduction, Edmund is the Chief Executive Officer of DeChained, a crypto-based education and advisory platform, and the Managing General Partner of DeChained Capital. Now, Edmund is a tech industry veteran with 15 years of executive experience leading organizations, including at such giants as Apple, MySpace, and Teads. He's also a registered investment advisor representative in the US with Series 63 and 65 qualifications and has been featured in top finance and cryptocurrency publications, including Forbes, US News and World Report, Cointelegraph and the American Banker. Edmund, welcome. I hope that you haven't been caught up in these horrendous weather events in America, both in the southern states and also in New York. The subway flooding that I observed on the news this morning really did look horrendous. I hope you've not been caught up in any of that, Edmund.
Well, Stephen, thank you for having me. And first and foremost, that was a hell of an intro. I should pay you to sort of lead all of my meetings, any appearances I do. That was a great intro. Yeah, thank you very much for obviously those, for those concerns regarding the weather. While I'm not in New York currently, I have a lot of friends and family who live up there as well as New Orleans. So I was very fortunate to not be in the path of this nasty weather. But yeah, there's certainly a lot of places in the U.S. that are getting hit pretty hard right now.
Yes, certainly are. Well, look, Edmund, I am very grateful to you for taking the time. And after, as you say, that wonderful introduction, I bet you can hardly wait to hear what you have to say. But what I want to start where I start with all of our guests on the talk show, which is really at the beginning, so that people can contextualize some of your expertise and also, you know, your perspectives by asking you a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved in the crypto space. Could you give us a bit of a potted history of your career to date, please?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I've been in the tech world for a while, even dating back to days of MySpace in the mid-2000s. And around 2011, I was working over at Apple at the time, and I was over at their headquarters, and I was sitting down at lunch with some engineers, and they were talking about this new protocol for money. And as they were talking about it, you know, they were leaning in more on the technology side, but as the conversation sort of progressed, they sort of uncovered, you know, that this also had a financial aspect to it, sort of as an afterthought, which was Bitcoin at the time. So, you know, it got me interested. I started, you know, once I got back home, back to New York at that point, you know, I started digging in and then made my first investment. At that time, things were a little different than it is today. There was no banks. There were no banks at that point that tied into any exchange where you could just buy and sell. I actually had to go to a drugstore. There was a MoneyGram in a drugstore where I had to send money overseas to an individual who would then credit an account that I had in an exchange based out of Japan called Mt. Gox, so that I can then purchase Bitcoin. So the landscape was slightly different. And when it comes to KYC, that is a KYC nightmare, I'm sure. But ultimately, that was sort of the way of investing at that point. And you know, since that time, you know, I've been involved in crypto, in tech. Since that point, the world's really converged around 2016 when at that time, Apple was moving away from, collecting a lot of consumer data. They were really putting their flag in the ground around consumer privacy. And concurrently, we also saw instances of, Cambridge Analytica coming to light, and a lot of the public seeing, information, data that's collected, on you, and sort of if it's put in the wrong hands, how that could be manipulated, combined with this newfound interest by, a lot of folks in mainstream around cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin. So with those worlds converging, I started to see where I could apply my background, both in tech combined with, an understanding of where this, landscape, especially this digital landscape, is headed over the next 5, 10, 15 years with the financial side as well. And financial, because that's the thing that's most tangible for, most of us on a day-to-day basis. It's something that we sort of interact with. It's a lot more tangible. And that's where I got the idea of, let's create a platform that can help, make that bridge between, the world of everyday traditional markets people are used to, stocks, equities, bonds, gold, to this new market, which really has been exclusively reserved for, a select few who are either in tech, in finance, or just sort of close to that world. And, since that point, it's been a really, enjoyable and fulfilling sort of job, really focusing in on trying to help everyday investors and everyday people learn about, blockchain technology, not necessarily, the meme coins and how you could speculate to get your prices up, but to really understand, look, this is something that, is revolutionary. And regardless of where the markets go and the prices go, this underlying tech is going to continue on, just like the internet continued on after the dot-com bust. And ultimately, we are seeing sort of the next evolution of what tech companies are going to look like who are now starting to build on this platform.
Okay, so very interesting as to how you've arrived to where you're at now. I want to come back, obviously, and talk more about cryptocurrency specifically in a moment, but you've talked there more broadly about digital cash and so on, which encompasses more than just crypto. Do you believe, are you one of these professionals, Ed, that thinks that, in about 10 years time or so, the US will be an almost cashless society, meaning that it's going to be sort of rare to find people carrying around bits of paper instead of using, their phone, their watch, or so on? Do you subscribe to that view? Do you think that's the way it's going?
Well, I think we're seeing that already. We've seen for a while now that from a generational standpoint, there's just been an uptick in, consumers, citizens who are using cashless options. It started with, NFC, near field communication, and you saw that with, iPhones. There are, certainly parts of the world, China, Japan, that have been doing this for much longer than, us in the US and Western Europe. But, with COVID sort of changing the way that we operate and the way that we buy, the way that we consume media, we sort of have gone down that path naturally. You see, I think a day doesn't go by when I don't get packages, from Amazon delivered to my door or from some other store. I really should talk to my wife about that. Just the simple, idea that, when someone hands me cash, there's something now that goes in the back of my brain that thinks, well, I don't know if I really want to touch that. I have two small children. Do I really want to think about where that, that dollar or that pound is gone? So, and you're starting to see a lot more people. There's a lot of studies that have come out more recently from Forrester and Pew Research Group that have talked about, this trend that really became very prevalent with those, the Gen Z millennials, those born, after the 1983. That's now started to go down the path of, the Gen Xers, the baby boomers, the people that are now, hitting or around retirement age, where they're also starting to prefer more cashless options. And the fact is this is even the concept of cashless is kind of, funny and sort of eye-opening when you think about we are so used to buying things online or using your credit card. And when people think, well, I can't imagine not having cash and buying things. but then they don't think twice. The first thing that they do is they pull out that credit card. You're not using cash for that. You're essentially swiping a card, which is then going through this very sophisticated financial system. But in fact, it's just a system of debits and credits, you know, linked back to your bank account. And that's really sort of what we have here with crypto as well.
Okay. All right. Good answer, I think. I mean, depending on who you believe, Ed, the cryptocurrencies are either the currency of the future, a risky, unregulated asset, a gift to organized crime, or as Nouriel Roubini, as you know, put it, you know, the mother of all bubbles. Why is it that you, despite these sort of wildly divergent views, why is it that you're a believer?
Well, I'm a believer, and I see, you know, where there's opportunity, people are going to take advantage. So there's certainly no surprise that, you know, where there is, you know, a lack of regulation or there's not as much sort of oversight, people are going to figure out ways to sort of manipulate and then capitalize for their own self-interest. So I certainly understand that. But the fact is that if you just look around at our current system, it's we forgive a lot of sins. You know, if you just look at just the amount, first, if you just look at compliance from KYC and AML standpoint, the numbers of just fines that banks have been paying just since 2000 has been insane. You know, we have, you know, Bank of America. I was looking at this just, you know, last night, you know, doing some research for this show. Bank of America has paid over $81 billion just in fines for financial offenses. And that's just looking at AML deficiencies and investor protection violations, or, you know, Citibank, Chase, Wells Fargo. I mean, the two of them is roughly about another $70 billion. So, and that's not looking even at, you know, at HSBC. They'll not only help, you know, the drug kingpins launder their money, they'll actually carry your bag to your car. So, you know, there's a lot of oversight that we sort of do here just in the regular traditional sense. And that's even, you know, not even counting the accounting world where it's come to light, sort of a lot of the practices where it's very easy to manipulate even financial statements. You know, you put out a manicured report once a quarter. It's very easy. And you saw that, you know, the titan for decades in the accounting world for years was Arthur Andersen. There was no one more pristine than Arthur Andersen. And it came to light that even their books are incorrect and willingly incorrect. So just putting that as a baseline to say, let's take a step back and just sort of look at what are we looking to fix? And it's not a system that is, you know, immaculate by any stretch of the imagination. So how do we use this technology to perhaps fix one, two, or more areas of that to make it a little bit more transparent, more auditable, and in effect, you know, help us actually focus in on trying to crack down on illicit activity. And this is where we've seen a lot of success because, you know, just, you know, speaking here in the United States, we have our Department of Justice and FinCEN, and it's fascinating to see just how much they have sort of grown their capabilities in the last year, both in-house, and obviously they've brought in some great, you know, hires, but also working with this new sort of industry in blockchain, which are these consultancies that focus in on helping to identify areas where there might be financial fraud, where there might be, you know, some type of illicit activity. And you're seeing, you know, companies like Elliptic or Chain Analysis, or, you know, there's a number of organizations that they have focused. Cypher Trace is another one. And in effect, if you look at some of these big regulatory groups and sort of the law enforcement groups, they're getting very sort of confident because at this point, they're mapping out hundreds and hundreds of millions of these these blockchain addresses that if I'm doing illicit activity, the fact is that especially on most transactional blockchains, Bitcoin and Ethereum being two of them, it's very hard to hide, extremely hard to hide. The tech might be phenomenal, but the fact is that human error seeps in, and it's really hard to be unpredictable as humans, because by definition, we're predictable.
Sorry to interrupt. Let me just cut across. I mean, I certainly recognize, as anybody who listens to the talk show regularly would attest, that traditional financial services and the actors within it, and you've alluded to some of them, their batting average in combating financial crime over the course of the last sort of 10, 20 years has not been great. I think we would all accept that. But one thing I think we can agree on, Ed, is that crypto does present some, how can I put it, novel challenges for compliance professionals that are seeking to tackle financial crime. Earlier this year, I was looking at some views held by, you know, various respected commentators, and you know, earlier this year, Janet Yellen said, and I quote, I don't think that Bitcoin is widely used as a transaction mechanism. To the extent it is used, I fear it's often for illicit finance. Now, she may or may not be right about that, but can you talk us through the features of cryptocurrencies that cause commentators like Yellen to have these concerns? Because many of our listeners will be in the traditional financial services industry, and they will be contemplating taking crypto, handling crypto, and they want to protect themselves against what they perceive as the vulnerabilities that are inherent in crypto. So could you talk us through the features that you think give those cause for concern?
Sure. And it's a great point too. You know, the fact is KYC and compliance in general is a requirement in order for cryptocurrency and blockchain to move forward. So this is something that whether you're looking at the big exchanges, which facilitate the transactions, all the way down to, you know, even myself, as you mentioned, I have a private investment firm. I go through all the compliance checks, and I do that willingly because we're not going to see mass adoption until that's sort of in place. But with that being said, I mean, there are you know, certain ways that people try to remain anonymous and ultimately try to hide from, you know, regulation and the law. So, you know, I guess the three ways I would sort of sum it up, you have your privacy coins, and Monero is sort of the biggest one, certainly in that area. And ultimately they use different structures, different operational methods, both in blockchain and also just in open source, because you could use it on any, you know, operating system on your computer. Whether that's, you know, grouping transactions together, and it's called obfuscation, or zero knowledge proofs, where only you would know that the transaction went through. So there's no record that it was completed, or using new stealth addresses. So it's constantly creating, new identification, you know, on blockchain that previously didn't exist. So those are starting to pop up, and there's a lot of attention around why these privacy coins really even exist and what purpose that they serve, because it's hard to argue that there's a lot of utility for them when most retailers, most governments, enterprises in general are not going to accept them. So that would be one of the bigger ones. Then you're seeing, you know, these new sort of sectors in blockchain arise that are used for anonymous purposes, but the end goal is ultimately to provide utility for existing sort of categories and sectors in crypto. So you have these middleware infrastructures, which are trying to help play that role of how do you make transactions, you know, on blockchain, but also shield your personal information from potential bad actors, or allow, you know, financial institutions to make a trade without signaling to the market. And you see that very common in traditional equities worlds through dark pools. And you have players like, you know, Raise Protocol, who allow you to sort of go through this whole mint, redeem, transfer kind of mechanism, where you take, you know, Bitcoin, you mint it into its Bitcoin equivalent on the protocol. You can then use that and send that to someone else. And then on the other side, they just take that that protocol, that minted protocol, and convert it back into Bitcoin so that that transaction can occur. Everything is transparent and clear for that protocol that facilitated it and all the other companies that are integrated with them. But if there's prying eyes out there, it would be very difficult to identify. And then you sort of have these, this is the one that gets really contentious, because you have these non-custodial projects out there that are called mixers. And for me, the utility is not there, but this is where you see a lot of hackers will use sort of this method. It's basically a relay system where you use that idea of zero, you know, zero proof, where you only know, you having a backup code would only know that the transaction occurred. And then that is then sent out to a whole other group of transactions. It's mixed together. And then when you withdraw, you use something like a relay system, which will then fund a whole new account that you create that didn't have any prior balance. So it becomes very difficult to identify. But the fact is you have, you know, regulatory groups like the IRS here in the United States that put out this bounty to find all these consultancy groups who would be able to sort of work around these very advanced technologies to hone in on how can you still track it. And at the end of the day, 10 out of 10 times, it's usually the human on the other side of the computer that's leading, you know, all the traceability.
Okay. So, Ed, if we go back to, and I want to come back to revisit the issue of privacy coins and mixing, but if we go back to, as it were, first principles, for the benefit of listeners who are not as familiar with crypto as you are and perhaps I am, Bitcoin, as we know, is based on the blockchain, where all transactions are recorded and can be linked. The reason, as I understand it, that criminals have at least historically been able to operate with anonymity is that Bitcoin addresses are not registered to individuals and are only accessible by the owner, who has the login details to the Bitcoin wallet. And it's the respective wallets, as it were, that can be linked, which allows the transactions on the public ledger to be linked. So in other words, even if it was suspected that transactions were in some way related to criminal activities, the authorities would have a very hard time tracing back to any particular person or entity. Now, that has been the position historically, but I recognize and accept that exchanges of the type that you have described have helped to overcome the question of anonymity by requiring their customers to undergo due diligence in the same way that banks require their customers to undertake due diligence as well. Now, am I right so far?
Spot on.
Okay, yeah. I'm spot on. Now, notwithstanding that we are clearly therefore moving in the right direction, from a compliance perspective, if I can put it that way, the fact remains, doesn't it, that crypto continues to feature characteristics, if I can describe them in that way, that make them attractive to criminals. And you know, for example, the absence of any sort of inbuilt geographic limitations, I imagine, makes it difficult to resolve, you know, which jurisdiction or jurisdictions you potentially regulate underlying activity. The fact that there are inbuilt geographic limitations might make the question of, you know, regulatory jurisdiction and territoriality more difficult to determine. Do you accept that despite the evolution in, you know, the way in which we diligence wallet holders, that there are characteristics or vulnerabilities that remain?
Sure. And it's sort of the situation of the more that things change, the more that it remains the same. Because if you even just go back to just the 90s, when, you know, the proliferation for the internet, there was this common misconception that just because of the nature of the internet, because it was cross-border, that it wouldn't be able to be regulated. And the fact is that just wasn't true. You know, all these, you know, law enforcement groups created their ways of tracking, the ways of enforcing. And you know, we even just saw within the last year, not just here in the US, but also internationally, you know, countries have come forward and said, look, if you break the law, whether you're an exchange or an individual, we will prosecute you in or outside of our country. So the idea that, you know, there's no jurisdiction, if you are a citizen of a country and you commit a crime, barring certain countries, there are repercussions. And you've seen, you know, obviously countries sort of work together, whether it's, you know, on a case by case or Interpol, et cetera. But in terms of, yeah, you mentioned, you know, one of the challenges is that you're anonymous when you are on the blockchain. But the sort of the Achilles heel is, now how do you get the money off blockchain? And ultimately that's where it comes down to, you have to be able to cash it out from a financial institution. And that's where initially, you know, the onus was placed on the exchanges in order to do KYC and AML. And you're seeing, you know, a growing trend towards that, especially here in the US and Canada and the UK as well. But now there's even whole new sort of another wave where there's a whole, there was a law that was just recently passed. It's now actually putting the onus on actual businesses who are accepting transactions. And that's more of a sort of a admission of saying, look, compliance is a bigger issue, and we all need to sort of expand responsibilities here. It's the Anti-Money Laundering Act of 2020.
Yes.
Sorry. These things are like burned into my brain.
Yeah, of course. I understand. Now, Ed, you make a really interesting point, because, you know, whatever mechanism criminals utilize, either to facilitate the commission of predicate crimes or to launder the proceeds of those crimes, the weak point for them is always the as you describe it, the cash out point. Okay. And that is why, as you've described so eloquently, exchanges are now required to ask questions of their customers. But within the traditional financial services space, organizations are required not only to conduct due diligence at the sort of onboarding stage, either of customers or of their customers' money, by reference to source of wealth or source of funds checks, but they also have to keep a very keen eye on the transactional activity that occurs during the life cycle of those customer relationships. Where is such oversight on the blockchain?
So this is where, you know, there's a lot of debate. The banks certainly have, you know, the responsibility for monitoring money coming in and out of the accounts, but do they have the authority with a right to be able to then monitor your transactions, your day-to-day transactions. And at what point is there a sort of a line for consumer privacy? So there's been, a growing number of organizations that have, sort of come in and helped provide solutions around, digital identity, whether you're talking about IBM all the way down to, even these decentralized exchanges, these DeFi exchanges, Aave and Compound saying, we're actually now going to create permitted, liquidity pools for institutional investors. And we have to pre-authorize before you can even invest in it and go through all the KYC and AML. This is where things get interesting because there are a number of platforms out there. There's one called Ontology that I really like that focuses in on this decentralized identity framework. It's built on the, the World Wide Web Consortium's decentralized ID protocol. And it's a way of, having your identity, that verification stored on the blockchain, and then being able to then use that as you, go through, your daily transactions, travel, et cetera. So there are, solutions out there to verify identity. The flip side is do organizations, do governments have the right to then store that information and tie it back to you? And that's sort of where a lot of debate lies.
I mean, I think my point is a slightly simpler one, and that is that banks and other financial services businesses are legally obliged to monitor transactional activity, not only to verify the identity of their customers and source of wealth and source of funds, but to actually monitor transactional activity. And I think a lot of people's issue with blockchain technology and crypto is that, it's the Wild West in the sense that, yes, maybe people are being verified on the way in and on the way out, but what's going on, on the blockchain, the transaction activity that's actually occurring whilst they're participating in this is not being monitored. It's not being policed. Now, I don't know whether that's a fair observation, but it's certainly an observation that's being made. If we go back, though, just to perhaps a couple of simpler points. I mean, I can think of some, uses of crypto for illicit means, just in the same way that I can think of uses of traditional financial services for illicit means. And for example, we've seen cases where you can purchase illicit goods using Bitcoin as a payment method. So, drug dealer one sells drug dealer two some narcotics, and the payment is in Bitcoin. And nobody is actually monitoring that transactional flow of Bitcoin between drug dealer one and drug dealer two. Secondly, we've seen ransomware attacks where payments by Bitcoin are being demanded. We saw that, for example, with the Colonial Pipeline attack. Now, blockchain, I read that it's been described as anonymous but not private. As we've already discussed, the anonymity stems from the fact that, a party transacting on the ledger is identified by a blockchain address from which, the value can be sent and received. But historically, at least, an account can be created without providing personal identifiable information. But blockchain isn't private, since all the transactions on the ledger, as we've already discussed, are a matter of public record. And every coin is obviously associated with a particular transactional history. Let's talk then about the cash out point, and the particular vulnerability that criminals have at that point in the process if they have used blockchain in furtherance of their criminal activity. They need to find a way to cash out without being detected. And as I understand it, what many of them do is turn to mixers, as you described them earlier. Now, these are people, I think, that can be found mainly on the dark web, who typically provide customers with some form of newly generated Bitcoin address, I think. Is that right?
It is. You don't even need to, at this point, go external and source someone to provide you an address. If you went on to some of these services, and I obviously won't promote them because I don't agree with them, but they'll create one for you with a single click.
Really? So what they're doing through the provision of their service is that they're providing you with an effective disconnect between yourself and the Bitcoin wallet address, so that in cashing out of the cryptocurrency, you can't be linked with a series of suspected transactions.
Correct. And they'll even move money to that account that previously didn't have a balance, which if you've ever used Ethereum, you know that that could be very difficult because you need to have some type of ETH in that wallet in order to do a transaction. So yeah, it's called a relayer, and it's becoming more prevalent, but the issue is, and you see a lot of these consultancy groups, these specialists in cybersecurity, cybercrime, popping up to then work with these regulatory groups to say, here's how you're able to trace it and ultimately tie it back. And then when you look at, you know, the fact is most of these transactions at the end of the day are happening on these blockchains that are that for every single transaction, they're telling you the date, the amount, the time, and then it's tying into very well-known identifiers to these mixer services. So there's ways of being able to identify that this money did not come from you or I, that it tried to get clean. And those are signals. And that's where, again, you're seeing just in the last year, especially here, you know, in the U.S., the Department of Justice is borderline sort of cocky at this point, because it's for them, it's becoming probably easier to track blockchain movements than cash.
I see. That's really interesting. And I want to come back to that. When you use, again, of course, we don't want to promote this, but this is by way of educating our listeners. When a criminal seeks to use a mixer to obfuscate mm-hmm. their link with a series of potentially suspicious transactions, do they pay a fee? I mean, every money launderer knows that there's a cost to laundering. And, you know, in the traditional space, it can be anywhere up to sort of 50%. Mixers, I presume, in the crypto space charge a fee, do they?
I'm going to put a disclaimer that I can't answer this from experience paying a fee to wash my funds. Of course, just being familiar with the services and I want to keep up to date. The fees are not as much as you would think. You're talking about a percent, maybe
really?
Up to 3%.
Okay. And I guess their business model is volume, right? You can make a lot of money charging a low percentage if you're doing it for a lot of people. I don't, correct, in making that point, mean to suggest that a lot of people are utilizing crypto for illicit purposes, but you know, that must be the model that the mixers are using. I tell you what, Ed, let me ask this question. What do you think the cryptocurrency crowd would think of a rule that required them to retain access to the keys of every wallet that they create or administer, and to turn over those keys to law enforcement when they received an official request? I mean, that's exactly what banks have done for decades with bank account numbers. So the question really is whether, you know, the keys should be treated any differently. And the point of this question is really to get to the heart of a big policy issue. which you're familiar with, which is, mm-hmm. is blockchain technology designed for security or is it designed for secrecy? Because, you know, we know this much, don't we? You know, you can't have both. The backers are quick to tout blockchain security, how blockchain ledgers can ensure transfers with no chance of theft and so on. While, you know, the critics claim that the only reason blockchain is popular is because of the secrecy that attaches to these transactions. How do you think the crypto crowd would react to that question?
So I would hope that they will be compliant with what the law states. I would rather that, you know, the individual is ultimately responsible for holding the private key and turning it over when they are subpoenaed by, you know, the law enforcement crowd, versus there be a backdoor built. That to me is a nightmare. Any backdoor, well, certainly governments can use it. Any bad actor can also find it as well. So I would prefer the former. But with that being said, there's also a growing trend where the idea that you hold a cold wallet, you know, a USB looking device to store your cryptocurrency and keep that in your home, I don't see that being a very sustainable model and one that will probably stick around for, you know, the very, you know, long-term future. The fact is that you've seen it here, you know, across sort of the Western Europe and the U.S., many of the banks have already been granted rights to actually custody your assets. So what you'll see is a growing trend towards, you know, people actually moving, you know, digital custody to either the banks or these, you know, regulated financial institutions. Speaking, you know, someone who I custody digital assets for my investors as part of my firm. I have a firm that an institution that I use for my cold wallet, and they do all the storage and all of the process from withdrawal. And then I have another organization that I use for hot wallets, and they have this model called MPC, which is a very, you know, more advanced security mechanism. So I see that the actual custody and holding of these assets will start to shift from the individual to financial institutions in the very near future.
I see. Very interesting. Now, you referred earlier to privacy coins, which is an area of interest, I think, to a lot of our listeners. And I think you referred to Monero. Mm-hmm. Now, so that I can understand this, Monero, I believe, employs what is referred to as ring signatures. Mm-hmm. That is, it broadcasts decoy wallet addresses with every transaction, which has the effect of confusing, you know, anybody that wants to observe these transactions and link particular individuals to them. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep. And they also use a couple of other things like zero proof as well, but that's the obfuscation is sort of their MO.
I see. And I mean, look, I can remember 30 years ago, a debate that raged around offshore types of offshore vehicle and anonymized bank accounts and numbered bank accounts and so on. And, you know, there was a crowd that said, hey, you know, everybody's entitled to a degree of confidentiality. Not everybody who seeks confidentiality is a criminal. And then, of course, the opposite side of the argument is that, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, why should you be concerned? We're all familiar with this debate, right? So I'm not suggesting that anybody that uses a privacy coin is a criminal, but we have to be realistic about the features of some of these cryptocurrencies that will attract criminals. Is it the case that some jurisdictions are actually outlawing privacy coins?
It'd be very hard to outlaw because it's open source, and it ultimately there'd be very difficult to stop them. What we've seen, though, are the exchanges limiting, you know, the listing of them. So if it's harder to buy, that's where it becomes, you know, sort of confined to certain groups who are going to go out of their way to acquire it. That in and of itself creates a scenario where it's a lot easier to trace and to track.
I see. And can I ask this question? If somebody has traded or utilizing a privacy coin such as Monero, I can understand that cashing out of that through exchanges would be difficult because of the measures that we have spoken about. But what about intra crypto trading? If you go from Monero into Bitcoin or Ethereum, is that easy? Is that a route so that you cash out of a privacy coin into a more respected form of crypto and then cash out into the traditional financial system?
In doing that, you would have to go onto, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain or yes. Ethereum blockchain. And that's where human nature comes in, because then you could easily be tracked. If you see, you know, BTC, which is Bitcoin, was just, you know, sort of added to a wallet formerly part of XMR, which is Monero. It's clear as day. Yep. And that's where a lot of these consultancies and law enforcement are sort of smiling and saying, what used to be in the shadows is now in the light.
Yes, very interesting. And as we know, sunlight is the very best disinfectant. I mean, I'm conscious, Ed, that we've been focusing on the sort of more negative aspects of crypto, although I hope you'll appreciate why that is, given the nature of our audience. Sure. The purpose is obviously to educate in terms of understanding the inherent vulnerabilities and how to respond. But there is, of course, a lot of cause for optimism, isn't there? And you know, you've pointed out that no form of traditional financial instrument is is without forms of abuse, and there's been a lot of it. There's certainly a lot more cash money laundering around the world than there is crypto laundering. There's no question about that in my mind. Mm-hmm. And there is cause for optimism, because you know there are other blockchain technologies which allow for automated anti-money laundering sort of fraud detection on the ledger. That's right, isn't there? There are developing requirements that would block or flag suspicious transactions prior to those transactions even being implemented. Am I right about that?
You're correct. And the other thing I would just add is it also addresses sort of an issue that I don't think we've touched on here, which is traditional KYC and AML rely on that individual having identification. And the fact is, you know, I saw a World Bank number. There's about 1.1 billion people in the world who don't have any proof of identity. So how do you do KYC and AML with them? This is where, you know, but the fact is actually, this is actually fascinating, is that, you know, while, you know, many of these individuals, whether you're talking, you know, Southeast Asia, Africa, you know, South America, while many of them may not have access to, you know, banking services, or, you know, it's difficult for them to get, you know, proof of identity, for the most part, rates of cell phone ownership is through the roof. So yeah, it creates sort of this platform where, okay, maybe there is sort of a solution here from that might be blockchain based that can now have that, you know, digital identification.
Yes. Yes. And look, as with any innovation, any opportunity, there is a risk and reward calculus that needs to go on. And we need, I think, not to lose sight of the enormous benefits that can be derived from cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology in the form of democratizing access to these forms of currency by the people that you've just referred to, right? The sort of otherwise financially disenfranchised.
Absolutely. And when I talk about that, you know, a lot of people assume, well, it's in another part of the world. It's not affecting, you know, people here. And it's eye opening because, you know, even here in the U.S., 20% of adults in the United States don't have identification. And whether it's for financial reasons, whether it's for immigration reasons, that means that they can't get a mortgage, can't get a student loan, start a business. It puts them back in life. If there is a solution to help address that, it would be negligent to not pursue to how that solution can be created in a compliant way.
That's a very interesting take on it, Ed. Ed, I'm conscious of time, which has, as ever, sort of run away again. I'm going to end by giving the usual caveat around you not being qualified to give investment advice, and nor, in fact, do you have the gift of prophecy. But where do you see Bitcoin by the end of the year?
I do have the qualification for investment advice, but I'm not giving it. It's if I had a crystal ball, you know, I would assume that, you know, just based on the amount of supply, or the limited supply, I should say, that, you know, is right now existing on many of the exchanges, that it's representative of a price point of roughly 55 to 60,000. I just did an analysis for, you know, our members yesterday on this, which we're slightly below that now. I think it's roughly about 48K. So there's still, you know, a lot of room to go. And the fact is, this current market is not being driven by retail investors. In fact, a lot of it is being driven actually by financial institutions who are either investing themselves or creating products that they're going to be rolling out to their customer bases. So I wouldn't be surprised to see us, you know, eclipse, you know, maybe even 50% higher. So 75,000 US dollars by end of 2021.
Yeah. And it's interesting, your point about this not being driven by retail investors, I think, is very, very pertinent. I mean, what we've seen over the course of the last 24 months is a much greater involvement of institutions in the adoption and acceptance of cryptocurrencies. And one would hope that as they become more involved in and exposed to crypto, so, you know, a rising tide is going to lift all boats, right? Including the compliance standards that are applied to cryptocurrencies in consequence. Would you agree with that?
I fully agree, and I'm excited about, you know, how far compliance has come in the last, you know, 12 to 24 months. It's the road for growth for crypto and blockchain. So I'm excited for it.
And respectable practitioners in this space, you know, certainly all those respectable practitioners that I have had dialogue with in this space, including your good self, accept that if crypto is going to succeed, if it's going to gain more wider and general acceptance, that it has to embrace the compliance challenge and bring itself essentially on a par with traditional financial services. I mean, that's certainly, you know, what I'm hearing. Do you agree with that?
I couldn't have said it any better. That's, yeah, it has to abide by the current financial system, and in order to be a part of it, it has to sort of open up to, you know, being compliant and sort of adapting to the financial institutions.
Yeah. Well, Edward, on that very optimistic note, can I thank you on behalf of all of our listeners for your participation in today's talk show? I found it very, very enlightening. And I think there are genuine causes for optimism, whilst obviously ensuring that we maintain our guard to avoid exploitation by people who would seek to take advantage of some of the vulnerabilities of cryptocurrencies that we've discussed today. I hope that you've all enjoyed today's talk show, which will be made available on various platforms for download within literally a couple of hours from now. And I look forward to talking to you again on next month's show. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Stephen.